If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. I'm Eric Edelman, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor, and I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, who is professor emeritus at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributor to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you today?
You know, as is always the case these days, personally, I'm fine and kind of appalled at the state of the world. I, as we were about to get launched, and I know we'll talk about this more later on, I do want to note this is the third anniversary of the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. We're taping this on February 24th. And I think, before we go on to talk about some other things, we ought to note, on the one hand, the horror and the criminality of Russian behavior and the truly extraordinary courage and patriotism of the Ukrainian people, who are not just fighting their fight, but are also fighting our fight, whether we know it and appreciate it or not.
I agree, and we'll, unfortunately have to note that the occasion has been marked by one of the more disgraceful episodes in American diplomacy, which was the UN vote today on the resolution marking the third anniversary. We'll get to that in a minute, but it's very hard in the Trump era, to keep track of everything. The Steve Bannon famously said they were going to flood the zone with shit, and they're certainly succeeding at that. In fact, as I might have said in an earlier part of my career, they're over fulfilling the plan, which is bad, I think, from their point of view in some sense, because I think it also gets in the way of whatever kind of consistent message they're trying to send to the American public. And that might be good for those of us who are opposing them or opposed to them.
And it also means they're going to trip over themselves. I mean, they are tripping over themselves. For example, that is sort of interesting to note that, that Musk sent out this completely outrageous demand to federal employees. Tell me everything you've done in the last week or you're fired.
Five bullet points.
And Kash Patel and Hegseth and actually a bunch of other heads of federal agencies said, no, we have our own procedures. Now, that doesn't mean they're nice guys who actually care about their employees, but I think they're, you are seeing some of the inevitable internal dissension. I would just add,
the gang leaders fighting among themselves.
Yeah. I would just add to that. I don't know your experience in government, but mine is both when I'm personally in it, but actually more from observing things, that even when you have a reasonably homogeneous administration composed of people who are serious and skillful and above all experienced and sane, people still end up really hating each other and stabbing each other in the back in ways that are kind of hard to believe. It's partly just because of the nature of the pressure cooker. But when you have a bunch of characters like these, you can very quickly expect them to begin acting like the inhabitants of a viper pit. And I think you're just beginning to see a little bit of that, but I'm sure there will be more of that. I mean, I'm sure there will be ice picks going into kidneys all over the place over the next 4 years.
Yeah. I mean, one of my observations about Trump 2.0 versus Trump 1.0 is that, to your point, in the first Trump administration, there was not backstabbing, there was front stabbing. I mean, people were, you know, picking up the phone and calling Maggie Haberman or Jonathan Swan directly. The president was doing it. You know, others in the administration, you know, kind of, you know, carrying out all sorts of internecine warfare in the pages of the newspapers. My sense is there's a little bit less of that kind of leaking, but I don't think there's any less of that kind of infighting going on. And we can actually get to that when we talk about the UN vote, because I think that there's some of that on display. But I wanted to really begin with the firings in the Department of Defense on Friday night. You've written about that in the Atlantic, and we'll put your article in the show notes for our listeners and viewers. I made a brief appearance on PBS News Weekend on Saturday evening to comment about all of this. You know, you wrote quite powerfully about the potential impact of all this. I would just want to say a couple of things. One, first of all, C.Q. Brown is one of the finer military officers that I have, you know, had the pleasure of dealing with over my, you know, time in government. I got to know him a little bit over the past year and a half in my capacity as both a member of the Defense Policy Board, but also a co-chair of the National Defense Strategy Commission. For an administration that purports to want to prioritize the Indo-Pacific and emphasize the need for innovation, he was the perfect, you know, senior officer to have in the position he was in as the chief military advisor to the president, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I think it's put aside everything else, this is just an enormous loss for the Trump administration, but an enormous loss for the nation. And of course, a travesty and a totally unfair circumstance for General Brown, who's going to be fine because he's going to go on to, you know, other things and probably more lucrative things that'll, you know, take less of his time away from his family and allow him to enjoy more of his stomach lining as he ages. I'm saying this advisedly because I also know that he is a dedicated listener to Shield of the Republic. So I hope he hears what I just said, because I mean every word of it. And it is, you know, a real shame for the men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces that they've lost a leader like that.
Yeah. So I completely share your view. I did have, we're Sabbath observant. So I turn on the computer Saturday night and I read the news and I send a note to my editor at the Atlantic and saying, would you like me to write about it? And then like half an hour later, I just said, I'm not gonna be able to get to sleep until I write something. So I wrote a piece, which they turned around very quickly. The first and foremost, absolutely. I've gotten to know him again in a number of contexts. As part of the Secretary of the Air Force's advisory group, and also some other work that I did for him and others. And what a fine officer, what a thoughtful, decent, cerebral, decisive. This is, as I said in the article, you know, I've had two kids in military service in wartime. And when that happens, you look at all officers a little bit differently than one might otherwise do. You say, would I care to have my son or my daughter serve under this man? And you know, the answer is, with C.Q. Brown, absolutely yes. So this was a terrible loss. I think he was, there were no grounds for his dismissal. I want to talk about the dismissal too, because beyond C.Q., there are a number of disturbing things here. I think he, of course, had a target on his back from Peter Hegseth's book. I think some of this was this very dignified, very thoughtful address he gave when he was the head of the Pacific Air Forces right after the George Floyd killing or murder. We should put that in the show notes too, because mm-hmm. It was a model. You could see there was restraint. You could see anger. There was reflection on his experience as an African American who's had tremendous success, but is also known racial prejudice. It was the kind of statement that would bring people together. I think it actually played an important role in calming things down. I was a dean during that time, and people have forgotten just how fraught that was. And, you know, one hates to say it, but, you know, I think he may have been fired for being Black.
As Admiral Franchetti was fired
for being a woman. Right. And then, you know, as our listeners probably know, so he was fired, Admiral Franchetti, General Slife, who's the vice chief of staff at the Air Force, and then three of the top judge advocate general officers of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. That's quite sinister because, right. You know, as a colleague of mine just said, the first thing you do when, you know, you really want to take down the rule of law is you go after the lawyers.
Right.
So I
think there's a line in Shakespeare about that, right? First kill all the lawyers.
Yeah, that was the Jack Cade. And there's a bit of a Jack Cade type there. So everybody go off and check Henry VI. I want to talk a little bit, though, also about what this says about Hegseth, who I think the Secretary of Defense, who I never thought much of, but this was contemptible in many ways. So one way in which it's contemptible is, like you, I've been in the position of having to fire people. And I know if you have to fire somebody, you explain to them what you're doing and why, and you do it in person, if humanly possible. And you don't run away from it. So these guys did it Friday night, you know, really sort of in the dead zone of news coverage. There was no explanation of it. It was not done in person. And you know, that's the work of a coward. Maybe Hegseth is a physically brave soldier. I have no idea. But this was leadership by cowardice. And I think, you know, people who've been in organizations in tough times would recognize that's what this is. I think one of the consequences of this is that although in general my view, even though I don't always sound like this, is you give people at the top of major government bureaucracies like the Defense Department the benefit of the doubt that at least they're trying to do the right thing, that maybe they're mistaken, but they're trying to do the right thing. Pete Hegseth deserves none of that. He will need to prove that he's not a bigot and that he's not a misogynist. He'll have to prove that he's not a white supremacist. One thing I went into in the article is, you know, he has this tattooed on his bicep, Deus Vult, God wills it, which is a lot of the white supremacists have taken on board. And he said, oh, it's just the Crusader. Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about what the Crusaders did when they took Jerusalem. They spent 2 full days killing every Muslim and Jew they could get their hands on, including the women and children. So I think it permanently tarnishes him.
I particularly appreciated your quotation from Thomas Asbridge's History of the Crusades what happened when they sacked Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Stephen Runciman's 3-volume History of the Crusades also has a pretty gory account, of that episode as well. So I was glad you did that.
Well, thanks. The main thing, though, is just I suspect he does not understand any of the things that I just said.
Right. Sure. He doesn't.
But I think they will come back to haunt him. I really, maybe that's wishful thinking, but I think so. Don't you? Do you?
I agree. For absolutely no reason given. You know, both Hegseth's comments and the president's announcement, you know, basically, you know, had a lot of positive things to say about Franchetti and General Brown, but without any explanation whatsoever for why they were relieved. And therein lies, I think, the message itself, right? Which is, it's, as you and I were saying earlier, in part, it may appear to be a firing based on race and sex. You could certainly draw that conclusion from, you know, Hegseth's comments in his books about this. But it also basically suggests that since there was no cause, unlike, you know, the apologists have been, you know, full of, you know, red herrings about, well, you know, Stan McChrystal got fired by Obama, or Obama didn't let Mattis finish his term as CENTCOM commander, or, you know, MacArthur was relieved by Truman.
For a reason.
They were all relieved for cause, for a reason. And here, I think the unstated reason is I want to install personal loyalists. And that's reinforced by the point you made about the firing of the JAGs. And that, you know, what I said on PBS is what's troubling about this is that, you know, military officers don't swear an oath to a president of the United States. They swear it to the Constitution. And the JAGs are there because we're not like the Russians, to make sure that orders are legal, that they reflect the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the laws of armed conflict, the Title 10 statute that in the U.S. Code that outlines the roles and responsibilities of the U.S. military and the civilians in the Department of Defense, the Constitution, and whatever treaties we are, signatories to and to which, you know, we are obliged to follow. And, you know, Hegseth made it quite clear. We don't want anybody to give us an interpretation we don't like of that.
Right. By the way, you know, one of the things that will, I mean, one of the consequences of this is, as you and I both know, and Shakespeare, among other things, talks about this too. When you're actually in a war, there are violent emotions that are released. And this is why you have discipline, you know, to prevent people from doing monstrous things so that, you know, you don't become the thing you fight. And this is, Hegseth resented legal restrictions. He believes that war criminals should be get the, you know, absolutely the benefit of the doubt. And this is...
And played a role in Trump's intervention in the first term in a couple of cases,
right.
You know, exercising, you know, I think, unfortunately, command influence that ended up, you know, overturning a number of convictions and ending some cases before they got to the trial.
And there will be service members, unfortunately, who will take advantage of that and who will do dreadful things. And that's on them. We should also just mention one other thing before we move to the next issue, which is his replacement. So apparently, news stories today are saying that one possibility was Michael Carrillo, the very, very competent Central Command commander.
Extremely, extremely.
Who's done an exceptional job.
I agree.
But in many ways, and actually would be a very, very good chairman. And instead, what they did is they dipped down into the ranks of a 3-star who has had actually 7 years when he was a National Guardsman, who is apparently a talented officer, and I don't doubt that. He was an F-16 pilot, who then has really spent most of his time in special operations and as military advisor at the CIA. That is not, and you're allowed to do that by presidential exception only. I mean, the norm is, the law actually says it's supposed to be either a service chief or one of the combatant commanders, which makes sense. So in other words,
Or vice chairman.
So this is, in other words, that you've had people with very, very serious experience at the top of the military managing these vast organizations composed of hundreds of thousands of people. That is not the world of special operations. It's a really important point. I've been getting emails actually from British friends who read the piece and said, you know, you're absolutely right. Said one of the problems that the British Army has had is that, you know, the Special Air Services had kind of had a undue prominence in terms of people who became chiefs of the general staff. And the result is conventional war fighting really fell by the wayside. So with all due respect to General Kane, he is not qualified for this job, A. And B, fairly or not, the suspicion of being a political general will always hang over him.
Right.
And once again, he will not deserve the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know General Kane, so I really can't comment, but I take your points, you know, in terms of background and experience, in terms of what is needed for an era of great power, you know, competition and the kind of war we're seeing play out, both in Europe and to some degree in the Middle East as well.
Move on to happier things.
Well, I'm not sure there's anything going to be happy in today's discussion. As part and parcel of a general reorientation of U.S. policy away from supporting Ukraine as long as it takes, President has decided that he wants a deal on Ukraine. He wants it in the worst possible way. And my experience is when you want something in the worst possible way, that's usually how you get it. And today we saw this example of the UN General Assembly resolution that's been passed every year since the war began, condemning essentially Russia. There have been, you know, a number of countries, supposedly the so-called Global South, who have voted against this, but the U.S. has always voted with its European allies to condemn Russia. You know, the U.S. attempted to pressure the Ukrainians to drop the language in the resolution that labeled Russia as an aggressor. And they were unable to get the Ukrainians to do that. They tried to offer a substitute resolution, which would not have named Russia as the aggressor. They couldn't get enough votes for that. And they then ended up voting against, not even abstaining, but voting against the resolution with Russia, which thanked us for our vote. Eritrea, Nicaragua, you know, North Korea,
Belarus.
I mean, this is the company we're keeping, you know, right. In the UN.
I mean, I weep for my country when I think that's who we march with. Yeah. We march with those people. I mean, it's disgraceful. Doesn't really capture the emotion one should feel at this. I agree with you. I think, you know, I can't tell whether it's simply that, you know, they prefer the Russians or that they've got the idea, which, and I think that may lead into a discussion of deals and making deals, that, okay, this is the way you kind of sweeten up the Russians so that you can really get the deal that you want, as opposed to understanding that this is giving a concession, a huge concession, and damaging your moral credibility, you know, as far out as the eye can see. But whatever it is, it was shameful. It may have been personal pique at the Ukrainians, at Zelensky. You know, with this administration, I will never underestimate the role that personal pique plays with these guys.
Look, one can say, and you see some anonymous voices in the press saying, "Well, Zelensky really misplayed Trump," you know, and I can see that. I mean, Zelensky's comment, particularly the one about Trump, as true as it was, that Trump is living in a kind of sea of Russian disinformation. It was absolutely pressing a button that we know sends Trump, you know, into the overhead, you know, with the allegation that he's a Putin puppet. You know, it allows him to indulge his, you know, the Russia hoax nonsense that he, you know, has been inveighing against since almost the time he took office in early 2017. What struck me about this, you know, before we get into the deal making part of it and the negotiating, you know, pros and cons of how they are handling this, it struck me that, you know, Mike Waltz and Hegseth both had enormous difficulty kind of, you know, dealing with the question of, well, is Russia the aggressor? I mean, this is like a very straightforward question. I mean, and it's, there's just not any doubt about it. You know, Hegseth says, well, it's complicated. You know, no, it's not. Waltz basically kind of misdirected and said, well, who would you rather have negotiating, you know, on behalf of Ukraine with the Russians, the greatest deal maker who ever lived? And, you know, Marco Rubio's comments just in general have been, you know, have been totally out of character for everything we've seen him, you know, say since he came into the Senate in 2010 and, you know, onto the national stage, right? I mean, you know, he was talking about his experience as the child of Cuban immigrants and the importance of democracy and freedom in American foreign policy. He was, you know, kind of a neocon. Now, I want to do say this, which is my suspicion and what I have heard from some people is that Waltz and Rubio remain actually relatively well disposed to Ukraine, that the way they talk with Europeans behind the scenes is quite different from what we've seen in public. And that obviously these comments that we're seeing on Fox for the most part, but not just Fox, are intended for an audience of one. And it's in part because they're under unrelenting pressure from kind of the J.D. Vances, Don Juniors, you know, Stephen Miller, Tucker Carlson's of the world, who want to extirpate any sort of vestige of the old Republican foreign policy establishment, and that they are under constant pressure to show their, you know, Trumpist, America first, you know, bona fides, which leads to this sort of, you know, North Korean-like, you know, behavior when discussing the president.
So I believe you, and I'm willing to believe that of them. But, and this may be...
That's not an excuse, by the way. This is just an explanation.
But here's the, I don't know, the moralist or the theologian in me. I think, first, there's some lines you just don't cross, and I don't think you or I would ever cross that line of saying something vile to please Mr. Big or Mrs. Big, and you know, say something else otherwise. I mean, that's not worth it. But I genuinely believe that for the Rubios, and you know, we both knew, we both met with Rubio. I've never met Hegseth, no loss. But you know, I knew Mike Waltz a little bit, and I'm sure you did as well. I think you do damage to your soul. You really do. I mean, I think you will not come out of this a completely whole human being. You know, there's a part of me which just hopes that at some point their children will grow up and read about this, and in their early 20s, confront these people and say, how did you possibly do that? And, you know, I think it's particularly as you get to a certain age, you know, a good guideline is this the kind of thing that my kids or my grandchildren would be ashamed of? And for sure, this will be one of those things where the children and the grandchildren, if you've brought them up in any way decently, should just say, God, I can't look up to dad or grandpa anymore. And, you know, which is about as devastating a thing as you can think.
Yeah. We should talk about the negotiating tactics here.
Yeah, such as they are.
Yeah. I mean, first, I mean, just preemptive concessions, just as a general rule, are never a good negotiating tactic. They're a particularly bad negotiating tactic with, you know, with Vladimir Putin, I think. I mean, and I think it's just encouraging the Russians to actually, it's going to have the opposite effect of what they anticipate. I don't think that, you know, either this vote in the UN or all these preemptive concessions about saying what, you know, what we don't think will happen or what you know, we don't think can be negotiated. And they've tried to walk it back a little bit. I mean, the president today was saying, I hope Ukraine gets some of its territory back in negotiation. I mean, you know, but it's a little late.
So let's you and I talk a little bit about this, because, I mean, look, life is filled with negotiations. Trump is a real estate is a developer kind of guy. He's got Steve Witkoff, who I believe is a perfectly competent real estate lawyer, or at least so I'm told. And I think it might be interesting for our listeners to talk a little bit about how negotiation in the international realm, and I would say particularly negotiation over war, is different and is played by different rules. What one part of which is something you and I have talked about over time. There are times when you don't negotiate, when the act of negotiation is in itself a concession. I mean, for me, you know, with me all, it's a little bit like, well, what's his name? Said about Plato, you know, wherever I go, I meet Plato coming back. Wherever I go, I meet Winston Churchill coming back. Alfred North Whitehead. Yeah, who said that about Plato. You know, Churchill did not want to embark on any negotiations after the fall of France. And it was really kind of coerced into responding to a feeler that came, I think, through the Italians.
It was from the Italians. It was from Ambassador Bastianini, who was the Italian ambassador in
But London. Because he knew that the act of negotiating with Hitler after the fall of France would be problematic. Or think about Lincoln dealing with the Confederacy. He was not going to negotiate with rebels. And absolutely right. It's not that either of them were averse to deals. You know,
right.
Churchill helped cut the deal with Michael Collins. He was perfectly willing to negotiate with the Soviets. But there are times when the act of negotiating is itself a kind of concession.
Yeah. And, you know, you and I have actually taught this case, so it's a little unfair, but.
It's not unfair. It's our podcast.
Yeah. Well, but just, I think it's worth, you know, sort of reminding listeners and viewers what the circumstance Churchill found himself in May of 1940, which is that he was nobody's first choice to be prime minister. He became prime minister because he had been for, you know, 7 or 8 years, you know, the most consistently, you know, anti-German voice in British public life, and warning about the dangers of Hitler. The Tory party's first choice after Chamberlain resigned, you know, in the wake of the collapse was Lord Halifax, the foreign secretary, who, I mean, became foreign secretary, but Halifax, who had been an archipeaser, that was their first choice. This is after the fall of, this is after the debacle in Norway, actually, this all happens. So Churchill is, you know, he's prime minister, but he doesn't have command yet of the war cabinet. And he's got Chamberlain, interestingly, in the cabinet as Lord Privy Seal, if I remember correctly, I think, in the cabinet.
Yes, I think so.
So what's very interesting about it is Churchill actually, he doesn't immediately say no to Bastianini's proposal. He actually allows a debate, you know, in which actually Halifax makes the case for, yeah, maybe we ought to talk about this. And, you know, in the end, Chamberlain, maybe because of bitter experience, you know, ends up supporting Churchill, and they shut it down, and there is no, you know, they don't go ahead and negotiate that. And of course, part of what Churchill's worried about is that if the Americans see the Brits, you know, negotiating, they'll be, you know, less inclined to support Britain.
And he's worried about British morale, too. I mean, the part of Churchill's genius is he was able to convince everybody that, as he once said, that it was the British people who had the lion's heart. He was just privileged to give the roar. But in fact, you know, the Brits were of two minds. And in other words, he understood what he understood, to kind of go back to the original issue, is he understood negotiations are a political act. They're not about deals in the sense that buying a house or building a building. They're about politics, and they have repercussions. So even so I suspect that this UN vote looked trivial to people in the White House, or, you know, something where at some peak wouldn't matter. Not understanding this is a major political act that you've just committed. And the same, you know, this also ties into what we were talking about with Pete Hegseth. I don't think he understood that what he just did was a major political act.
Yeah, Trump just, today in the meeting with Macron afterwards when they were doing the press conference, I saw a clip of it. I haven't seen all of it, but he said, I do deals. That's what I've done deals my whole life. This is what I do, you know. And of course, he's the author of The Art of the Deal. But when you read The Art of the Deal, you realize that this is not anything like any international negotiation you or I've ever been a part of. And lack of preparation, which is, I think, never a good thing in international negotiations because details really do matter. By the way, he's not the only one who, you know, I think, you know, can, you know, fall afoul of that. I mean, I think there's no small measure of some of the problem we have with Taiwan right now over the fact that Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon really didn't care about the details of the Shanghai communique. They just wanted it to get done so they could have their visit and, you know, and have the diplomatic triumph. That's always dangerous, I think. The other thing that the kind of warning bells went off for me was the comments that Witkoff made about the time he spent in Moscow with Putin, apparently a lot of time with Putin alone, with, you know, no Ambassador Tracy, who you and I both know, who is actually a first-rate diplomat, who might have been able to be useful to him in kind of reading body language and listening to what he said, what Putin was saying in Russian, which might not be precisely what the interpreters are telling Witkoff it is. You know, there are a lot of reasons why, but walking away saying he was trying to kind of make, I mean, he didn't say it quite this way, but trying to make friends with Putin, you know, which does put one in mind of many of the British, you know, I was thinking of Lord Londonderry, who, you know, tried to make friends with Hitler.
I think it's a temptation of political leaders, particularly, and I have to say, in the American system, I mean, the Brits fall for it too. I mean, Chamberlain fell for it in a big way, you know, that you're convinced that I've established personal rapport with the chief, with the guy on the other side. We can do a deal. And sort of not understanding that, particularly when you're dealing with a dictatorship, there is no personal relationship. That's manipulation. That's
right.
He doesn't actually like you.
Right. Or care about you. Right.
He couldn't care less about you. But, you know, if you think about real estate dealing, I may have to do another real estate deal with that guy. And it's better if we can go out for drinks.
Right.
And talk about our families. And, you know, that makes it all the better. And that it's just not the way it works. And also, I think these guys don't understand how thoroughly outclassed they are by something you and I have talked about, the fact that Putin is a KGB thug, well-trained as a case officer, used to manipulating people, very experienced at it, and very good at it. And, you know, I also think there's a kind of cockiness that you see particularly at the beginning of an administration, which I've actually picked up from, I don't have many sources inside this administration, but I've sort of picked it up indirectly from a number of people. These guys really feel, you know, Biden people were completely incompetent. That's a very normal sort of feeling. And we've got this. We know exactly what we're doing. That is always, I think, a recipe for disaster because, you know, if there's one thing that you can be quite sure of when you come in to a new administration, you don't have it all and you're actually riding for a fall. It's just you're not quite sure what fall you're riding for.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, there's a long history of, you know, unanticipated, you know, crises and mistakes in first years of administrations. I mean, actually, the first Trump administration was rather remarkable because I don't think that really did happen. I mean, in at least not in a serious way. There might have been other, it might have been various pratfalls, but there was no Bay of Pigs.
It was a relatively benign international environment
for the first 4 years. Yeah,
and he was fairly timid about it too. I mean, I think one difference is Trump rather comes in thinking that he can really remake the world now.
Yeah, master of the universe.
Yeah, So no, it's that. Let me ask you one last question before we move on to our last topic. Having said all this, do you hold with those whose fundamental interpretation is, okay, we're just betraying Ukraine, that's it, it's all over? Or do you hold with those who say, this is very bad, these guys have no particular emotional feeling for Ukraine, but the kind of deal that they want at the end of the day is not one that simply sells Ukraine down the river, A, and B, the Russians are likely to overplay this, and when they do, we'll try to find some way to bring them up short. So which of those two schools do you fall into?
I'm not sure I fall into either school because, I mean, I think, as I was kind of suggesting earlier, I think there are people who really do just want to sell out Ukraine and don't give a shit.
It's with the Tucker Carlsons.
Yeah. And the J.D. Vances and the, you know, Don Juniors and whatnot. I think there are other people, more responsible people like Rubio, like Waltz, who are trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. They're trying to use, I mean, I think they're, I think they're making a mistake, but I think they, and maybe Besant too. I don't know Besant well enough to make a judgment since he's been playing a role here in this, you know, rather repulsive, you know, sort of extortion racket that we're running with the Ukrainians about their natural resources. Now, of course, Zelensky opened the door to this. Right. I mean,
this was originally their idea.
This was originally their idea, but it was had a different kind of valence. The idea was continued assistance will give you access, you know, to this stuff. And in Trump, you know, with Trump, who, you know, the great deal maker, this has become, I can't believe the idiots in front of me, you know, before me gave away all this stuff to the Ukrainians. I want to get it all back. You know, I want to be paid back, and we're going to, I mean, it's become just extortionate and, you know, sort of the worst kind of blackmail you can imagine. I don't know about Besant, but I think Rubio and Waltz are saying, look, we got to get a stake in this. I think they're being genuine when they say if the U.S. has a stake somehow, that will, you know, substitute for a hard security guarantee. I think that's fool's gold. And I don't think it will actually wash or work. But I also think the Russians are likely to overplay this, in part because they're being given so many concessions up front.
Yes.
That I think that they think they're gonna, you know, be able to get much, much more. And I do think there are people telling the president, look, you run the risk here that if you provoke a collapse in Ukraine, it will be much worse for you than even Afghanistan was for Biden.
Yeah. And I agree with that.
And I do think Trump cares about that because it affects him politically.
So, okay, dealt with that one. Now, I guess I should explain to our listeners that, I mean, you and I almost invariably see eye to eye with just, you know, like a 2% difference, which is enough to sustain a podcast for how many years now?
We're coming up on 4.
It's unbelievable. But there has been an area where you and I have been disagreeing, although I think we're gradually coming to a meeting of minds. We're kind of pulling open the curtain of the green room of Shield of the Republic. And that is, how seriously should we take some of the ideas and some of the ideologies that are floating around the Trump world? And I'll give my take, you give yours, and, you know, let our listeners judge with an unjaundiced view. So my view is, I mean, a lot of this is crazy, and a lot of it's certainly dangerous. Some of it has some nub of things that are real, but I think we have to take the ideas seriously. I think there are several different streams out there, from kind of techno-futurist Muskism to kind of autocratic, anti-democratic, sort of very dark impulses that are anti-liberal in the most profound way. There are some streams which are purely and simply kind of reactionary. Others which are sort of, you know, people who are refugees from a liberal world. So I mean, those are my rough categorizations, but I think we do have to talk about them. And at least that's my view. Why don't you give me your take?
So I think that the problem begins, you know, the fish rots from the head, as I'm fond of saying. The problem begins with the fact that Donald Trump has no ideas other than self-aggrandizement and, you know, feeding his limitless vanity. So I don't think he's particularly motivated by, you know, any, you know, ideology per se. What that means is I think there are a lot of people around him who have their own ideas and try to kind of create a intellectual veneer, although I've been using the word intellectual very advisedly, but so I mean, there is, for instance, Steve Bannon. And I think Bannon is clearly influenced by, and again, this I think is from his own mouth, by European writers who were plainly fascist. He told our colleague and friend, Gerard Araud, the former French ambassador here, that he was a huge admirer of Charles Maurras, ideologue of Action Française, a, you know, kind of proto-fascist movement in Third Republic France.
Who narrowly escaped execution after liberation on the grounds that he was mad.
Right. So, you know, my doctoral dissertation is about U.S. policy towards, you know, fascist Italy. I know a little bit about Italian fascism. You know, he even found, you know, Italian fascist writers that I found obscure, you know, Giulio Nevola. I mean, you know, it's a sort of extreme right of the fascist party, because the fascist party under Mussolini actually had kind of left and right factions. So I think Bannon is sort of, you know, comes out of a kind of really kind of traditional European, you know, far right kind of bent. And then I think there's this other current, which is kind of, you were talking about, as techno-futurist. I would call it techno-monarchist. This is, you know, Curtis Yarvin, you know, Bronze Age pervert, you know, Costa Alamarayu. And these people, I think, are, you know, half-baked Nietzscheans who favor kind of red Caesarism or some kind of technological dictatorship. Peter Thiel has said democracy has failed multiple times in public. I mean, I think these ideas are like very half-baked for the most part, you know, but very, very dangerous. I mean, you know, half-baked Nietzscheanism, you know,
can kill you.
It can kill you, as we saw, you know, in Europe in the mid 20th century.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, though, I mean, there's another dimension to it as well, which is, I mean, I agree with you. Trump is, in a certain respects, an empty vessel, other than his own, you know, vanity and vindictiveness. But I also think there are plenty of people who are more than happy to use him.
Sure.
And who do use him. So someone like Russell Vogt, the head of OMB, is, you know, absolutely a zealot.
And that's a Christian nationalism that's even separate from what we've just been discussing.
Exactly. And I think the Christian nationalism, you know, was it the Seven Mountain ideology, which is that the Christian nationalists have to capture the seven mountains of society and academe, industry, and a bunch of other things. But I think those people have real ideas. Some of this got spilled out in Project 2025. I don't know how much of that is Christian nationalist, how much of it is. And some of what they're doing is they're tapping some very old strains of American, I don't even like to call it conservative thought, because it's not really conservative. It's sort of fantasizing about a world that didn't exist, but it was, which is associated to some extent with the South, particularly after the Civil War, but it was there even before the Civil War. And I think those people are consequential because they have Trump's ear, at least for now. And I think, I mean, the figure who is most concerning in all this is J.D. Vance. I mean, Musk and Vance are the two most concerning figures. And I think, you know, Musk is the sort of Peter Thiel techno-autocrat. And with Vance, I think it's a very dark view, which is partly religiously informed, I think. So you're kind of wrinkling your nose.
I'm just saying our colleague on the Bulwark, Tim Miller, you know, kind of has noticed that, you know, that J.D. Vance was a Catholic for about a nanosecond before he started opining on Thomas Aquinas and got reproved by no less than the Pope.
But J.D. Vance is going to be around longer than the Pope.
Yeah. Point taken.
He's not an intellectual, but I think he fancies himself one.
I agree with that. I mean, he's a faux intellectual, and I think he's also very ambitious and clearly has been, because he spent time at Silicon Valley as a devotee of Thiel. He knows Curtis Yarvin. They've talked. He clearly has himself talked about many of the themes that Yarvin does, the sort of this idea of red Caesarism and, destroying. The thing that unites all of these different things, by the way, is fundamentally their anti-liberalism.
Yes.
I mean, they are all opposed to liberal democracy and essentially to the system that the founders established. I mean, it's profoundly anti-Lockean.
Yep. It's anti-enlightenment, and it is antithetic to the founding. I mean, it is striking how little they talk about the Constitution. I mean, other than the kind of zealots for a unitary executive, which basically the president gets to control absolutely everything in the executive branch. But they actually don't talk about the founding very much. I mean, and which is a departure in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's a longer conversation, but I mean, some of the advocates of the unitary executive, for instance, in the Bush administration, a lot of people said, oh, this goes back to Bush 43 and the unitary executive and et cetera. A lot of that, had to do with the role of the president as commander in chief in wartime. It does not apply to what's going on now, in my
opinion. Yeah, that's true. But I do. This is one where I think there's a call for some Republican soul searching, because, I remember a lot of these discussions, and there's long been a celebration of executive power. I think particularly because it looked like the Republicans had a kind of a structural minority for a very long time,
right,
in Congress.
Fair. And a lot of it grew out of some of the experiences, post-Vietnam, where Congress was imposing a lot of restrictions on the presidency. What's so striking about the current moment is, have you heard from Congress recently? No. I mean, the Congress has just kind of vanished. It's not doing anything to protect its own prerogatives. What is the most single greatest power that Article One confers on the United States Congress? It's the power of the purse,
right? No, it's quite incredible how supine they've been. Is it that going to be that way forever? I don't know.
I hope not. I mean, I because not. Our I mean, otherwise our constitutional system will be, it's already out of balance. It'll be even more out of balance than it already is.
Well, I would say that what we should do is we should probably bring in somebody else who can talk about the ideas that are here and what the intellectual movements are, because, you know, at the end of the day, ideas do matter, even crackpot ideas.
One should be very wary of just writing off crackpot ideas and saying, oh, those people are nuts, because sometimes the nuts are in power.
Yeah, I mean, it's what was that famous line somebody, you know, pointed at Trotsky in some cafe in Switzerland and said, who's going to make the revolution? Mr. Bronstein over there? Well,
yeah,
stranger things have happened.
Yeah, I mean, the Bolsheviks, you know, were a minority actually, you know, in the Constituent Assembly when they seized power. So,
well, actually, you know, this is, as you know, I've been on a Solzhenitsyn kick for a while. Do you remember reading Lenin in Zurich?
Yeah.
I mean, and one of the points that he makes is Lenin's this kind of ridiculous figure in a certain way with these kind of kooky ideas. The only problem is he ends up running the Soviet Union.
Right. Well, on that cheery note,
God, I hope things get better, Eric. I mean, you and I both are gloom and doom, but I'd like a little ray of sunshine.
When you see one shining in your window, call me.
Will do.
All right.